put between her and McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area written by local authors. On today's program, I'll be reading more from Heaven for Beginners, Betsy Holloway's reminiscences of her life growing up in Durham. Chapter 7, Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition. The early part of this chapter discusses general nationwide issues. We'll pick up with the part of the chapter dealing with local Durham area activities. Wartime changes in the 1940s came early to Durham, for a site only 10 miles outside the city was selected for construction of a wartime military installation to be named Camp Butner. Hard on the heels of the initial announcement arrived a housing shortage. Those who came to build the camp needed living accommodations, and Durhamites heard for the first time the plea that for the next 5 years would form a constant refrain, "Rent out your extra bedrooms." Within a month after the Pearl Harbor attack, Durham had become a sea of khaki, with a steady stream of military personnel traveling between Camp Butner and the city. The Raleigh-Durham airport was taken over by the Army for pilot training. The acceleration of activity had begun in mid-December, though, with the announcement that the 1942 Rose Bowl would be held at Duke. Government officials feared that a large gathering on the West Coast might encourage the Japanese to launch a military strike. According to a professor of that time, the change of location was unpopular with the Duke team, and especially with the band, both of which had looked forward eagerly to the Pasadena trip. Students en masse suddenly felt sentimentally impelled to spend the holidays with their families instead of returning to school in time to attend the game, and, noted the professor disapprovingly, what should have been a great occasion degenerated into a drab affair. With Camp Butner so close, the war took on a special, intimate urgency. Van Stratton's and Pritchard Bright carried complete stocks of officers' uniforms, gabardine trench coats, accessories, and insignia. Durham Transportation Corporation instituted a special bus service between Durham and Camp Butner, 55 cents per round trip. Local service clubs decorated the USO centers for Christmas, and young Durham women acted as hostesses in the social clubs at Camp Butner. Soldiers who dined in local restaurants frequently found their checks paid by hospitable Durhamites, who took special pride in their men in uniform. On holidays, dances and special programs for servicemen took place throughout the city. The Malborn Hotel filled up early on weekends, and sometimes as many as 50 soldiers slept in the lobby, in chairs, on sofas, and on the floor. Manager E.I. Bug never charged these overflow guests, but allowed them every courtesy, including baths in the public rooms. Durham Public Service apologized frequently for its crowded buses, citing rationing of tires, gasoline, and metal, as well as the added traffic to and from Camp Butner. In order to fill some of the draft-caused vacancies in its ranks, the company hired several women as bus drivers for the duration of the war. One of them quickly acquired the reputation of being an iron-fisted tyrant. Few people were brash enough to argue with her, but once, when she ordered a male passenger to discard his cigar, the man politely objected, "I'm not smoking." Visibly annoyed, the driver pointed out, "You have a cigar in your mouth," whereupon the man retorted blandly, "I have shoes on my feet, but I'm not walking." Central to everyone's consciousness was the newspaper. Together with carrying daily accounts of battlefield action in each theater of operations, the Herald issued orders for the battle on the home front, as well as dispatches on its progress. Over and over, local firms bought ads to recite the wartime litany. Conserve gasoline and rubber. Conserve food and electricity. Save scrap metal and newspapers. Rent out spare bedrooms. Volunteer as a nurse's aide. Go to church and pray for a victorious peace. And above all, buy war bonds. Ads, along with the weekly war ration guide, tried valiantly to explain the intricacies of the point rationing system, which no one ever understood. Concern about careless talk prompted a combined radio and newspaper campaign advising, "If you hear it on the radio or read it in the paper, you can repeat it. If you hear it rumored, keep it to yourself." Urging citizens to float a flag instead of a rumor, the Sun offered a 3x5-foot flag set for $1.50. Offering special subscription rates to men and women in service, the Herald also published a Week's News from Home column, designed to be clipped and mailed to servicemen who were stationed overseas. The columnists offered timely advice. Dorothea Dix advised on how to treat a returning veteran, with patience and forbearance, but with alertness to any failure to readjust to civilian life within a short time. Angelo Patry counseled on allaying children's wartime fears, and Genevieve Smith wrote on wartime buying and making one's dollar stretch. Perhaps more widely read than any other part of the newspaper were the columns of the beloved Ernie Pyle. Writing an account of his walk on a Normandy beach the day after D-Day, Pyle began almost nonchalantly. "It was a lovely day for strolling along the seashore. Men were sleeping on the sand. Some were sleeping forever." And continued with a moving account of the personal gear, Bibles, sewing kits, diaries, even a tennis racket, that lay jumbled in a row along the water's edge. On June 7, Baldwin's sponsored a heart-stopping quarter-page Herald ad that joyfully headlined the news, "Lafayette, we are here, again." Though several of my uncles served in the armed forces, our immediate family was fortunate enough to stay together throughout the war. My father, who was 35 when Pearl Harbor was attacked, would surely have been drafted had not his company requested his exemption, pointing out that his job was essential to the war effort. At home, he became a block captain, and was issued a weighty club that he kept in the top drawer of his chest, presumably to intimidate any reckless civilian who might disobey orders in an emergency. Once a month, we had practice air raids and blackout drills, and then we turned out every light in the house to sit silent and apprehensive in my parents' darkened bedroom, gazing into the blackness outside, until the signal sounded and the lights came back on, and we were safe once more. Posters, newspapers, and magazines exhorted us to save, conserve, and economize, and we did. We collected used cooking fats, bundled newspapers, and saved every bit of scrap metal we could find, tin cans, empty tooth powder tins, squeezed out toothpaste tubes. We carefully supplied the Scott and Roberts man with a hanger for each garment when he came to pick up our clothes for dry cleaning, and my mother took her own grocery bags to the Piggly Wiggly after the store announced that paper bags had gone to war. My father recapped the tires on our gray Plymouth, and the vegetable garden he grew each summer became a victory garden for the duration of the war. And we bought war bonds. My father squeezed enough money from each paycheck to buy a $25 bond, and every few days I pasted defense stamps into a book until it was filled, and I could proudly turn it in for a bond of my own. We had ration books for meat, butter and cheese, coffee, gasoline, shoes. Rationing and shortages were so common, in fact, that when the war ended, I was amazed to discover that the bananas I longed for were suddenly plentiful, and we no longer needed our coupon books to go shopping. During the rationing years, one had to stay alert to coupon values, which altered whimsically from one week to the next. But my mother and the other soldiers in house dresses always read the Herald's War Ration Guide, which each week provided the new equivalents for its readers' illumination. For example, all red and blue stamps in War Ration Book 4 are worth 10 points each. Red and blue tokens are worth 1 point each. Red and blue tokens are used to make change for red and blue stamps only when purchase is made. Important! point values of brown and green stamps are not changed. Some people quietly patronized the black markets, but because our family was small and my mother was imaginative about making clothes last and foods stretch, occasionally she augmented a meager meal with a side dish of fried squash blossoms. We had everything we needed without them. Considering such measures unpatriotic in the extreme, my parents would almost certainly never have resorted to them anyway. We had rumors throughout the war. My mother had begun renting out a room or two early on, when construction began at Camp Butner. Later on came servicemen and their wives and parents, so that for several years we had a steady stream of arrivals and departures. The need for housing was so acute that my mother never had to run a newspaper ad to rent out her rooms. More, she never dared to. Usually, the procedure remained the same. When a soldier received orders to ship out, he mentioned quietly to a friend that a room would soon be available. The following week, the friend's wife would move in, delighted at having the opportunity of spending a few weeks close to her husband. My parents could almost always find ways to make do, and, when necessary, our three bedrooms could become four. My father would move a bed into the sun parlor, and whoever stayed there simply closed the curtained French doors that opened into the living room. To further ease crowding, I slept in a small bed in my parents' room until the war ended, at which time the housing shortage eased, and I was coincidentally deemed old enough to move into a room of my own. With all three of us in a single room, the house seemed more spacious than it really was, and frequently our small dwelling, with its single bath, housed, in addition to my parents and myself, three soldiers and their wives. And once in a while, all three bedrooms unexpectedly emptied within a few hours, as orders arrived and a company shipped out. For me, the only child in a household of adults energized by the ever-present awareness of war, life was filled with interest and excitement. The homesick soldiers and their wives petted and played with me. The young women painted my fingernails, provided an attentive audience as I rode my scooter, entertained me with Itsy Bitsy Spider and Old Maid, and let me watch as they coped with the shortage in stockings by skillfully applying liquid leg makeup, on top of which they drew seams with eyebrow pencil. The men carried me around on their shoulders, showed me their ribbons and medals, blew perfect smoke rings, and taught me to sing, "Off we go into the wild blue yonder," coming down hard at the end, "Nothing can stop the Army Air Corps." In addition, I adored them, thinking them members of a sort of extended family, and weeping heartbrokenly when each one left. Several of them happy young newlyweds, most of our servicemen and their wives dropped out of contact within a few years. A few, though, stayed on in Durham after the war ended, and became our friends for life. Occasional difficulties arose. Sometimes our roomers were frightened awake by early morning gunfire, which proved to be our next-door neighbor, opening exasperated aim on the blue jays that brazenly plundered his huge pecan tree. One midnight, my colored tin chicken, up till then my favorite toy, unexpectedly came alive and took on monstrous proportions to chase me down endless halls, whereupon my screams alarmed my parents and our guests alike into a state of jangled wakefulness that lasted until the next morning. One young bride usually had a heavy coating of dust in her room, the result of overgenerous use of talcum powder as a dry shampoo. From time to time, linguistic perplexities appeared. Our northern guests habitually looked confused, even uneasy, on hearing that it was fixin' to rain directly, or that an ant had fallen off a lot, or that someone was on the poly list, or that a neighbor had given my mother a mess of beans. They were even more baffled when cut onions appeared on windowsills throughout the house, my mother's insurance against a cold's spreading between members of the household. Nearly all the soldiers who stayed with us were gentlemanly and quiet, but once in a while, perhaps distressed by news from Europe, one would utter a mild oath, thereby causing my mother to glance meaningfully at my father, who would shortly find an opportunity to take the errant young man into another room for a brief talk. Swearing was taboo at our house. I was allowed to give vent to strong emotion with "heck" and "doggone it," but my freedom ended with attempts at expanding my vocabulary to include darn and dern, which my parents thought unsuitable for a young girl. My father sometimes indulged himself in an emphatic, "Well, I swanny," when he was surprised or disturbed. I heard damn and hell only in their literal senses, and only in church, when a visiting evangelist felt compelled to use strong language in order to indicate the fate of the unsaved. Not all of our rumors were service-connected. Midway in the war, an attractive elderly lady, a New Englander, became a regular winter guest, whose return I eagerly anticipated for weeks each autumn. She sewed clothes for me, and played the Nutcracker Suite on her phonograph, so that I, for a few fleeting moments, an accomplished ballerina, could whirl dreamily and blissfully down the hall, and on my fifth birthday she gave me a charming miniature sink, equipped with a shallow tray in back that, when filled with water, enabled the tiny faucet to dispense a minuscule stream. I was enchanted by the gift, although, a war-wise, thrift-conscious child, I did somewhat dampen the occasion by inquiring politely how much it had cost. And once she gave us a glorious week at her beach cottage at Nag's Head, where I splashed rapturously in white foam and scrutinized strange leggy creatures on the sand, and once wandered, lost and tearful, between the houses, all on stilts and all ominously alike, until my father rescued me and took me home. When peace came, it came by degrees. Paris was liberated, and a crowd in Rockefeller Plaza celebrated with confetti, ticker tape, and cheering applause for Lily Pons, who, wearing her USO uniform, triumphantly sang La Marseillaise. Radio announcers throughout the country played French songs all day long. It was barely a month later that the new fashions began to appear. Early the following April, the city's lights went back on, once more outlining the Champs-Élysées and eliminating the Arc de Triomphe. May brought victory in Europe. June saw an enthusiastic welcome home to General Eisenhower, together with an end to the nationwide cigarette shortage. Japan surrendered in August, and in the midst of the ecstatic crowd in Times Square, a sailor bent a girl backward in an enthusiastic kiss, the photograph of which became one of the most reprinted images of the war. By September, life had begun a fairly rapid return to normal, as the War Production Board allowed U.S. manufacturers to resume production of automobiles, washers, electric razors, and radios. The armed services, meanwhile, were pondering how to dispose of excess war supplies that included a supply of Elizabeth Arden face cream, black, 40,000 homing pigeons, and 10 million pounds of contraceptive jelly. On the New Year's Eve that followed, the bars of Manhattan stayed open till dawn. One of the war's last unconfirmed tales emerged from Potsdam. Despite the vigilance of those who had been assigned to guard the premises, rumor had it that a confused-looking Joseph Stalin had emerged from a portable toilet to inquire confidentially of an aide, "Who was Kilroy?"
We take you now from the White House in Washington to the Supreme Commander for the Allied Powers in the Pacific, General of the Army, Douglas MacArthur.
My fellow countrymen, today the guns are silent. A great tragedy has ended. A great victory has been won. The skies no longer rain death. The seas bear only commerce. Men everywhere walk upright in the sunlight. The entire world lies quietly at peace. The holy mission has been completed. And in reporting this to you, the people, I speak for the thousands of silent lips forever stilled among the jungles and the beaches and in the deep waters of the Pacific, which mark the way. I speak for the unnamed brave millions homeward bound.
Chapter 8. Downtown. From the time I was 8 or 9, and therefore old enough to be downtown alone, Saturdays were pure bliss. Once in a while, especially when it rained, I stayed home long enough to join Let's Pretend at 11, traveling with Uncle Bill Adams and the Cream of Wheat Gang on a flock of geese or a stratocruiser to hear about exquisite princesses and enchanted frogs. Usually, though, Saturdays began promptly at 9, when my mother deposited me at the door of the Durham Public Library. The library had had its beginnings at an 1896 meeting of the Canterbury Club, a literary and civic group that had as one of its aims the cultural improvement of the city. Trinity College's Professor Edwin Mims suggested to the club's members that they begin a library movement, and the idea was accepted. After several leading citizens had promised their assistance, a citywide meeting took place during which citizens subscribed $4,000 to the project. Miss Lalla Ruth Carr, daughter of Julian S. Carr, and a member of the Canterbury Club, donated to the cause a lot at the intersection of Main and Chapel Hill Streets. Since the building was expected to cost more than was raised at the organizational meeting, several of the town's prominent women organized a board of lady governors of the Durham Public Library, whose purpose was to raise additional funds and to oversee the project. This group raised an additional $1,700 in pledges, enabling construction of the building to take place during the following year. On the 10th of February, 1898, the library opened its doors. The Durham Daily Sun of that date included a happy reminder to the townspeople. "The day has arrived. The event takes place this evening. The public library will be opened. A good start with books. Now let us carry it on to complete success." The following day, the Sun reported with pride on the new facility. "The building is a beauty in its arrangements for comfort, convenience, and service. One of the best to be found in the South. And it is estimated it now has some 1,500 or 1,600 books of inestimable value now on the shelves in its alcoves." The frame Queen Anne building included 8 alcoves for books, as well as 2 rooms for reception, reading, and literary purposes, 1 room for ladies, the other for gentlemen. On opening evening, the rooms, decorated with numerous arrangements of fresh flowers, were crowded by 600 or 700 enthusiastic citizens who had come to witness the inauguration of the new facility. A special children's reception was held from 5 to 6 p.m., after which the library was opened to the people of Durham. The Reverend W. C. Tyree offered the invocation, asking God's blessings upon the institution and on the efforts that had produced it. James Southgate offered words of hope, encouragement, and congratulation, and announced on behalf of the committee that the library was now open and dedicated to the people of Durham as their property and their pride. Major W. A. Guthrie responded on behalf of the town, commending those who had worked so diligently for the project's success. The Choral Society and the Durham Orchestra offered musical selections, and at the program's conclusion, the entire crowd sang "The Old North State" and "Dixie," with, as the Sun noted approvingly, "a gusto seldom heard in Durham." The forward-thinking philosophy of the new institution caused much comment. This library was the first in North Carolina to receive municipal support, as well as the first free public library in the state. By 1911, the library had acquired some 3,500 volumes, somewhat unsystematically arranged by the volunteers who worked in the facility. At that point, the city took the significant action of hiring a professional librarian, Lillian Baker Griggs. The first trained public librarian in the state, Mrs. Griggs was an energetic and enthusiastic woman who successfully expanded library services throughout the city and outside it as well. She opened branches in West Durham, East Durham, and Edgemont, as well as starting libraries at Watts Hospital and Durham High School. She also initiated a bookmobile service, the first in North Carolina, and supervised the organization of a public library for blacks. This facility would later be named the Stanford L. Warren Public Library. On leaving the Durham Public Library in January of 1924 to become director of the North Carolina Library Commission, Mrs. Griggs was succeeded by Miss Clara Crawford, who would hold the position for 35 years. During its meeting of 6 November 1923, the library's Board of Trustees adopted a resolution of appreciation for Mrs. Griggs' efforts that read in part, quote, Our regret at her resignation is inexpressibly great, and our loss seems irreparable. The community's debt to her will last as long as the library continues its beneficent work. Within a very few years of her arrival, Mrs. Griggs had pointed out to the Board of Trustees that the existing facility was inadequate for the library's many activities. Despite the vehement opposition of Julian S. Carr, then chairman of the board, Mrs. Griggs and other trustees decided to approach the Carnegie Corporation for funds to construct a new building. In the fall of 1917, the request was approved. A 2 years' delay ensued, occasioned primarily by Mrs. Griggs' war service, but in 1920, construction finally began. After the sale of the existing library property, Mrs. Griggs moved books and furnishings into temporary quarters at the Lockmoor Hotel, only a few hundred feet away from the new site on East Main Street, until construction could be completed. The new library opened on the afternoon of 6 July, 1921. A Durham Morning Herald editorial of that date extended congratulations to those who had worked to bring the project to fulfillment. "They have wrought well, and may the results in good to the community exceed even their fondest expectation." General Julian S. Carr, chairman of the Board of Trustees, was out of town on important business matters and was unable to attend the opening, noted the newspaper. He did, however, send a letter conveying his best wishes. Mayor J. M. Manning accepted the property for the city, H. L. Carver of the Board of County Commissioners for the county. The minutes of the Board of Trustees contained a report describing the new building as being constructed of cream tapestry brick with trimmings and columns of old ivory. The broad walk, imposing steps, and lovely trees in the yard make a most attractive approach to a southern library. The main floor, the report continued, was illuminated by natural light that, in combination with the golden oak furniture, produced a restful, airy appearance. Along with low tables and chairs, the children's area contained a lavatory where children who have come in hurriedly from play may wash their hands. The reading room had a fireplace which will add comfort and cheer on cool, rainy days. A balcony was added to the library in 1926. 4 years later, the children's room was established in the basement through the generosity of the Kiwanis Club, and after years of impassioned pleas from Miss Crawford. The new facility had cost $75,000, of which $32,000 was provided by the Carnegie Foundation. While the county's population increased several fold, this building would remain in use for over 50 years.
No one could be sweeter than the pretty when the meet her in the morning.
The morning.
When the morning.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.